Norman Finkelstein is an independent scholar with an outstanding international reputation. His works dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the politics of the Holocaust have been translated into numerous languages and have received praise from Noam Chomsky and the distinguished Holocaust scholar Raul Hilberg. He is the subject of several documentaries, including American Radical, which will be released later this year. It's a delight to be on the, at the same table with him. It's also a delight to be at the same table with my friend Issa Mikkel, who is a lawyer, a human rights activist, and a member of the New York chapter of the National Council of Arab Americans. He is a Columbia University graduate, and he's currently living and working in New York, where he's been an active member of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, and also of Adela New York, the Coalition for Justice in the Middle East, one of the endorsers of tonight's event. And I'll give you Larry's introduction as well, so that when he arrives, we don't have to sort of waste time, and he can just jump into his talk. Larry Hamm is known to many members of the Bergen County Green Party. He did a forum a couple of years ago on the Iraq War. He is the founder and president of the People's Organization for Progress, or POP, the co-sponsor of tonight's event. He served as the New Jersey State Director for the Million Man March. The New York Star Ledger has called him one of the New Jersey's leading voices against police brutality, against urban violence, and for social justice in all forms. And as it happens, he and Norman Finkelstein were at one time classmates. So we'll have a little reunion at this point. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Norman Finkelstein and we'll get underway. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak publicly. And today is a double pleasure because I get to see Larry Hamm, or as we knew him 30 years ago, he was a Dimu Changa and a very dear friend and not a compatriot. He was a comrade of mine and he still is, I hope, I like to think. And I look forward to him coming in at some point. Since I assume this is an activist crowd, I want to speak about practical issues, how we pursue the Israel-Palestine conflict and hopefully live to achieve a victory. And see a full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in June 1967. So what I want to do first is try to give some sense of where things now stand, the current picture, try to indicate where there's room for, genuine room for hope and optimism, and then how we can exploit that hope and optimism, or those optimistic factors, how to exploit them and hopefully advance the cause and maybe even achieve a victory within our lifetime. Let me give you some of the current, the most recent poll data on Americans in general on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and then to look at the poll data on American Jews. And the poll data on American Jews is actually quite interesting, and you can see definitely significant new trends. It comes as no surprise to most people in the room that Americans overwhelmingly, if they have to choose between who they support, the Palestinians or the Israelis, overwhelmingly see Israelis much more favorably than they do Palestinians. On the other hand, Americans overwhelmingly support what they call an even-handed U.S. approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict, and a large majority of Americans believe that Israel is not doing enough or not playing its role in trying to achieve a resolution of the conflict. A majority of Americans, a consistent majority of Americans, support a two-state settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And you could say among Americans in general, at least currently, the support for Israel, you could say, is broad, but it's not very deep. There's a very good pollster, a fellow named M.J. Rosenberg, and he said the following, and I thought it was an accurate remark, so worth quoting. He says, referring to the fact that American support for Israel is not very deep, he says, this phenomenon can be seen almost every day in letters to the editor columns. Every time an op-ed about Israel appears, especially if it is critical, there are a slew of letters to the editor. Most support the Israeli position, and almost without exception, they are written by Jews. That vast majority of non-Jewish Americans out there, which supposedly is so supportive of Israel, virtually never chimes in. And I think anyone who, for example, I used to read the New York Times letters to the editor, And whenever there were supportive letters for Israel, it was almost invariably, you could see it was a Jewish name that had bothered to write the letter. American opinion of Israel, it's well below their support for England and Japan. It falls roughly in the same category now as India and Mexico, which is, frankly, not very high. And surprisingly, at least it was a surprise to me, during the 2006 Lebanon War, half or more of Americans said that Israel and Hezbollah were equally to blame for the war. Given the kind of media coverage, it was a very surprising result. The more interesting case, though, is the question of American Jews. And there is no question, if you look at the poll data over, say, the past decade, that American Jewish support for Israel has significantly declined. The main pollster is a fellow named Stephen Cohn, and he wrote recently, "The attachment of American Jews to Israel has weakened measurably, continuing a long-term trend. Respondents to the polls were less likely than in comparable earlier surveys to say that they care about Israel, talk about Israel, or are engaged in any pro-Israel activities. Roughly about 30% of American Jewry, when asked, now say they feel distant from Israel. And interestingly, a strong majority of American Jews say that even if Iran does acquire nuclear weapons, they oppose an American attack on Iran. If you bear in mind that Israel keeps claiming that a second Holocaust is on the horizon, that Ahmadinejad is the new Hitler, and so on and so forth, it is a quite remarkable finding that still about over 60% of American Jews say we shouldn't attack Iran, even if they acquire nuclear weapons. The most marked change is among young people. About 35 to 40% of American Jews under 35 say they have a low attachment to Israel. And quite surprisingly, when asked, would you regard Israel's destruction as a personal tragedy? Less than half of American Jews under 35 said they would. I fall into a peculiar category because my own view, for whatever it's worth, is of course its destruction would be a tragedy. It's insightful that about less than half of American Jews under 40 believe that any longer. It's very obvious if you are in college, lecture on college campuses. I speak usually at about 40 schools a year, and it's quite obvious that there's virtually no support for Israel on college campuses, apart from the faithful gathered around the local campus Hillel. Apart from that group, you could say roughly now on a college campus, among Jewish students, one-third are within the Hillel faithful, one-third are utterly indifferent, and one-third are supporting the rights of Palestinians. I think that's pretty much how it divides up right now. Well, the obvious question is, what's going on? How do you account for this declining support? And all sorts of theories have been put forth. The most popular one to explain it is intermarriage, that large numbers of Jews, especially younger Jews, are intermarrying, and as they intermarry, they're losing more and more interest in Israel. The rate of intermarriage is now up to, I think, the current estimate is about 60% among American Jews. And there's probably an element of plausibility to that argument. I happen to have a different view on the topic. My sense is that what's accounting for the growing, the technical term they use in the Jewish literature is distancing, the distancing of American Jews from Israel. My own view is that this distancing is occurring because Israel has become indefensible on basic liberal principles. And after June 1967, Israel projected an image, and American Jewry projected an image of Israel as being a beacon of enlightenment in the Middle East, purity of arms, and all the other terminology that was used, or slogans that were used. And that image seemed defensible for about 20 years. But what you now see is significant cracks in that liberal image of Israel. Too much is now known, and what is now known can no longer be defended on liberal principles. Now, it happens that American Jews are overwhelmingly liberal in their persuasion, belief in the rule of law, and all the positions which come with being a liberal in American society. And that view of the world can no longer be reconciled with the reality of what Israel now seems to be. Or not only what Israel now seems to be, but also what the historical record shows about what Israel always was. So let me just give you a few quick examples. If you take the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict, the issue, we have older people in the room, and I suspect there are a lot of veterans of Woodstock in this audience. According to my friend, some of you were probably too old to attend Woodstock. So we'll say your children were veterans of Woodstock. And one of the tragedies of entering the 60s is people have trouble reconciling themselves to the fact that the 60s are over. They are. They are, yeah. It's pitiful, but it's true. And some people even came up to me before I spoke and mentioned how growing up they were reared on all of these myths about Israel, and it's really hard to shake loose of them. But it's become pretty compelling, and also a broad consensus exists. It's very hard now any longer to deny what that record shows. So you take a classical example for those people who remember back in the 60s, 70s, and even early 80s. The main historical question people used to debate is how the Palestinians became refugees in 1948. And the standard Israeli response, which I suspect everybody in this room knows, is that the Arab armies stood poised on the newly born state of Israel's borders, ready to attack. The Palestinians were then told by the invading armies to clear the field, and that they would return after the war was over. And that view lasted for a quite long time. It's now clear that that's not what happened in 1948. The basic facts are pretty straightforward. And you can even get them from very right-wing historians, like people like Benny Morris. And Morris says, now I'm quoting him, pretty close to quoting him, he says that the idea of transfer was built into Zionism, and it was inevitable. You want to create a Jewish state in an area which is overwhelmingly not Jewish. The only way you can do it is by expelling the indigenous population. And come 1948, the Israeli first the Zionist armies, then the State of Israel, took advantage of a war, exploited a war, in order to carry out the expulsion which was inevitable in Zionism. And most serious historians now refer to what happened in 1948, incidentally, including Benny Morris, refer to what happened in 1948 as an ethnic cleansing. If you turn away, if you put aside now the historical record, you look at the human rights record, about 20, 25 years ago, the claim was that Israel was unique among nations because it practiced what was called purity of arms. Its army practiced purity of arms. And even if you take mainstream human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch wasn't yet around in the 70s and early 80s. They were very reluctant to criticize anything said by Israel, done by Israel, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for bad reasons. The good reason was Israel's the outcome of the Nazi Holocaust, and people were sensitive to that history, and therefore Israel got a free pass. The bad reason was liberal Jews contributed significantly to Amnesty and human rights organizations, and there was a fear that these liberal Jewish organizations, liberal Jewish individuals, would pull the plugs on these organizations if they spoke the truth about what Israel was doing. And so, you know, well into the late 80s and early 90s, Amnesty would never make a statement denouncing Israel's use of torture against Palestinian detainees. But now, if you read the Amnesty reports and their historical retrospectives, they say, frankly, that since 1967, Israel was, I'm using their word now, routinely torturing Palestinian detainees. And the torture reached by the late 80s and early 90s, it reached epidemic proportions. During the First Intifada, 1987 to 1993, the estimates are Israel tortured about 20 to 30,000 Palestinian detainees in its prisons. It's a really grisly record. And by the 1990s, Amnesty was acknowledging these facts. Human Rights Watch was acknowledging these facts. The main reason they were now acknowledging it is really two reasons. Number one, as I said, it was reaching epidemic proportions. And number two, Israeli human rights organizations were now documenting Israel's record, most notably B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And so Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, they now had a cover. They were able to say, you see, we're just quoting what B'Tselem, an Israeli organization, said. And so they were becoming more frank about Israel's record. And the same thing is true on the legal diplomatic record and how to resolve the conflict. Over the past 20 years, a consensus has developed in the international community for resolving the conflict. There's, in fact, Israel-Palestine is probably, at this date, it's the least controversial conflict in the world in terms of trying to achieve a resolution. We're often told it's the most controversial, but factually, it's the least controversial in the world. That's not speculative on my part, and it's not trying to engage in hyperbole or exaggeration. All you have to do is look at the UN record on the topic. Every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on what it calls a resolution called Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. And you could just Google that, and you'll get the same results as I'll tell you now. Every year, the vote is exactly the same. It's the whole world on one side, and the United States, Israel, and a few South Sea islands on the other side. So this past year was 161-7, and it's always the same. The United States and Israel on one side, the whole world on one side. The United States, Israel, Nauru, Tuvalu, Palau, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands on the other side. And the terms of the settlement are completely uncontroversial because they're firmly anchored in international law. Israel has to fully withdraw from the territories it occupied in June 1967, and a future Palestinian state, as well as neighboring Arab states, have to recognize Israel's right to exist in peace with its neighbors, a fundamental principle of international law being it's illegal to threaten or use force against a member state of the UN. Israel is a member state of the United Nations and therefore has the right to live in peace, free from threats or use of force. And that's the consensus of the international community. I looked at a political body, but you could see the same thing if you look at a legal body. The highest judicial body in the world is the International Court of Justice, as all of you know. And in July 2004, the International Court of Justice addressed these issues because of the question of the wall Israel has been constructing in the occupied territories. I'll leave aside the question of the wall, which is not directly pertinent right now, and just look at what else the court deciding its advisory opinion. It said, number one, it's illegal under international law to acquire territory by force. Therefore, Israel has no right to any of the territories it acquired in June 1967. It said, number two, Jerusalem was acquired during the June 1967 war. Therefore, Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, they say, and I'm quoting them now, is occupied Palestinian territory. And number three, they said, in the issue of the settlements are illegal under international law, and they have to be dismantled. So on all the crucial questions bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict, there's a consensus in the supreme political body in the world, the General Assembly, and also in the supreme legal body in the world. In the case of the International Court of Justice, the vote was not even close. It was 14-1 on these issues which I just mentioned. And even the one dissenting vote, namely by Thomas Bergenthal of the United States, Bergenthal in his, what he called his declaration, he didn't actually call it a dissent, Bergenthal said, there can be no question the settlements are illegal under international law. So on the heart of the issue, namely this question of those settlements, all 15 judges agreed. And that's the basic picture, and it's a picture which I think is becoming more and more widely known, maybe not in all the details, but enough is now known that it's becoming more and more difficult for Israel to defend its or for defenders of Israel to defend it in public. And that brings us to the question for us in the room, namely, what is to be done? What should we do? And my opinion is, I've been recently reading Gandhi, and Gandhi, as you know, was famous for his strategy of what he called, his philosophy, not really a strategy, of what he called satyagraha. How many people know that? Okay. And I kind of liked the translation of satyagraha. Who knows it? What does it mean? Hold on to the truth. Hold on to the truth. And I think that's what we have to adopt for ourselves. The principle of, if we want to win this struggle, we have to know the facts, learn the documentary record, learn the scholarly record, and argue on that basis to hold on to the truth. And I think our biggest failing as, it's not much of a movement, our biggest failing to date is that we have never, or we have not, taken advantage of that truth, of that record which is out there, and which if we learned, if we acquired those powerful weapons of truth and justice, I think we can win. Let me just give you a couple of examples. Everybody, how am I doing for time? Am I off? Tell me. Okay. You know, take the example. I suspect everybody in this room knows the Balfour Declaration. Raise your hand if you know it. You've heard it. Right. And how many of you have heard of the Partition Resolution in 1947 when Israel became a state? Okay, we could say nearly the entire room. Now, the Balfour Declaration, everybody knows it because the Zionist movement made sure everybody knew it. After all, what was it? It was a couple of, about 90 words written by an obscure foreign minister named, his first name is Arthur Balfour, and easily forgettable, but they made sure everybody knew the Balfour Declaration. What was the Partition Resolution in 1947? It was just a General Assembly recommendation, like 10,000 other General Assembly recommendations which are ignored. But everybody in this room knows the Partition Resolution. And the tragedy is, how many people know what the International Court of Justice said in 2004. How many people know that the International Court said that the whole of the West Bank and the whole of Gaza are occupied Palestinian territory. That East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. That all the settlements are, to quote the court, a flagrant violation of international law. That was a huge victory. That was the Palestinians' Balfour Declaration. But nobody knows it. How many people know every year, for the past 10 years at least, that vote in the UN General Assembly peaceful settlement of the Palestine question? It has no lesser status than the partition resolution. In fact, the vote for the partition resolution was 33-13-10. It was very close. I'm talking about on these resolutions the past decade and more, it's 161-7. And it's not just one, it's every year. But nobody knows. Now, some of you may think, what's the difference? They're just paper resolutions. It's true, they're paper resolutions, but they carry a huge amount of moral weight if we make those resolutions known. How do I know that? I am sure everybody in this room has had the experience when arguing over whether or not Israel is a legitimate state or whether what it did was legitimate, everybody has had the experience of coming up against the partition resolution. It's impossible to argue against, or I've found it very difficult to argue against. It has a moral weight, that resolution. If we give it that moral weight, if we make the results of those UN deliberations known, if we make the results of the International Court advisory opinion known. Now, it's true that these resolutions, or in the case of the World Court advisory opinion, it's true they're not self-implementing. There's no force which is going to impose them. But that was true of the Balfour Declaration also. It was true of the partition resolution. In order to make that Balfour Declaration a reality, the Zionist movement, and you have to respect it, they were incredibly committed, they were incredibly well organized, they were incredibly disciplined, and that's how they turned it into a reality. Some people have the idea, several months ago I was in Lebanon and I met with some officials from the Hezbollah, and I talked to them about this issue, and they said to me, but you forget that Zionism served imperialism, and that's why the Balfour Declaration was passed and so forth. It's not really true. There were real doubts among the British about whether or not to support the Balfour Declaration. There was a real conflict. And that conflict ensued for the entire period of the British mandate. As most of you know, by 1939, the British decided that this Balfour Declaration wasn't a wise idea, and they issued the White Paper, effectively rescinding the Balfour Declaration. At every point along the way, the Zionist movement had to struggle to see that Balfour Declaration implemented and enforced. And they did it because they were well-organized, disciplined, smart. Of course, we'd also have to add to that they were ruthless, and I would not want to replicate their ruthlessness, but we should not let their ruthlessness blind us to the fact of the level of their commitment. It was very impressive. The same thing with the partition resolution. For though there are some people here who actually may be old enough to remember, but when the partition resolution was passed, Truman's main advisors, including Secretary of State George Marshall, were totally against it. And already by February 1948, they were talking about rescinding the partition resolution and imposing an international trusteeship on Palestine. The Zionist movement said, oh, no, you don't. You voted for it at the UN. And they organized and they fought very hard. Resolutions are paper resolutions. Of course they are. But then that's our job, to turn them into something real, to turn them into something which is actually enforced. The last thing I want to say, and I'll be done, is what I think we should not do. And the first thing, in my opinion, we should not do is get bogged down on abstract ideological issues, as in, are you now or have you ever been a Zionist? I think these are totally irrelevant questions. Personally, I have a stake in the question. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the theory of Zionism. But as a matter of practical politics, I think it's totally beside the point. I don't care whether or not you're a Zionist. My question is, do you believe in international law? Do you accept the opinion of the International Court of Justice, all 15 of justices, that the settlements are illegal? Do you oppose torture, or do you support torture? Do you oppose house demolitions, illegal under international law, or do you support house demolitions? Do you oppose the wall, which 14 of the 15 judges said was illegal under international law, or do you support the wall? That's what we should be asking people, and not playing these games of ideological purity, trying to test whether or not somebody is a Zionist or whether or not you believe Jews are a nation. I don't think these issues have any place if we really want to win. And the second thing, and the last thing, is on the question of this debate which has arisen in recent years of one state versus two states. We have to be serious about whether we want to win or whether we want to sit in the living room and have theoretical discussions, pretending to be little Bolsheviki's. Everything I mentioned so far, United Nations General Assembly resolutions, the International Court advisory opinion, all of it is premised on the two-state settlement. And that's our strongest card now. The strongest card is the moral and the legal case we can make. The moment you say that you're rejecting the two-state settlement, then we start from scratch. We start from the beginning. And we have to build up a whole new international consensus. That'll take probably around a century, in my opinion. No, I'm serious. I mean, literally, it'll take about a century to achieve. I don't think it makes any sense. Some people say the main argument you hear is, well, we've tried the two-state settlement, we've tried it for 30 years, and it's not worked. We've never tried it. We have to be honest about that. There are people in this room who are, go back a ways. All that was ever done in the 70s was, chanting mindless slogans. It was so empty, it was so vacuous. We would march through the streets. Everybody should know we support the PLO. Who cares if you support the PLO? It's totally irrelevant. I might as well say everybody should know I support Chairman Mao. Like, who cares? And that's what the whole movement was. It was totally unserious. And the results show it. It was monumentally corrupt. It was totally unserious. It was a form of radical chic. And the results show it. But now I think we have a real opportunity. 90% of it is due to the Palestinians, because they were the ones who extracted those victories. The World Court did not want to rule the way it ruled. They didn't even want to touch the issue. The Palestinians forced that issue on the international community, and it's to their credit. But now we have a real opportunity. I'm absolutely convinced we can win now. If we get our act together, if we're serious, if we're committed, show a little bit of courage. I'm not talking about the courage a Palestinian show. A little kid throws a rock at a tank and gets his head blown off. That doesn't happen here. It does not. Admittedly, if you're Muslim or Arab, yes, you face, and you don't have citizenship, you face, you know, quite serious problems. But that doesn't apply to 95% of the people in this room. 98%. The risks are very small. You just show a little courage. You learn the record. And I'm confident there's no reason whatever why we can't win. But we have to hold on to that one principle, the one that Gandhi enunciated. Hold on to the truth. Stick to the facts. Hold on to the truth. And, you know, there was a great line by that. I guess it's M.A. Cesar. And don't pick unnecessary fights. Don't try to prove your purity. And don't try to alienate people as a sign of how pure you are. There's a good line, the one by M.A. Cesar, the late Edward Said liked to quote it. There's a place for everyone at the rendezvous with victory. And we should bear that in mind. We're not out to exclude anyone. If you're reasonable, if you're just, if you're fair, there's a place for everyone at the rendezvous with victory. And speaking of rendezvous with victory, I see Lawrence Hem. I want to just say the one and only Lawrence Hem. No, come on. What are you doing? For those of you who don't know, when I went to school with, at that time we called him Adi Muchunga, everyone, Princeton was a very white place back then and very rich place, but everyone, from the richest to the poorest, every color, every religion, every race, everyone loved Adi Muchunga. And that's a fact.